This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by the Georgia Radio Reading Service, GARS. Hello, I'm Melanie Guralnick, and I'll be reading from the April 2025 edition of Vanity Fair magazine. The first story is called Editor's Letter by Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief. I always love Michelle Ruiz's cover profiles because she packs so much life into every sentence, and she gravitates to subjects with very packed lives. This month, Michelle talks with the eternally fascinating Gwyneth Paltrow, who, just when you think she might have receded, not into irrelevance, never that, but comfortably into the furniture, shows up somewhere unexpected, like, say, the Belle de Debutante in Paris with her daughter Apple, or making out with Timothée Chalamet in photos on the internet from their new movie called Marty Supreme, directed by Josh Safdie. And then, like magic, she's our main character all over again. Michelle visits Paltrow at home in Montecito, where they talk business, goop, and pleasure, her life as an empty nester, rebranded in rose-colored Gwyneth style as a free bird. After the wildfires in Los Angeles, Vanity Fair committed to supporting two local organizations helping affected families and industry professionals get back on their feet. Baby to Baby, which provides families in need with essential supplies from diapers and formula to clothing and blankets, and the Motion Picture and Television Fund, which offers emergency financial support and counseling to members of the entertainment community who have been impacted. Recovery from such a disaster doesn't happen overnight, so part of our commitment includes keeping attention on the city's efforts to regroup and rebuild. In this issue, we feature a portfolio of haunting images by Stuart Pally, who began photographing wildfires in 2012 as an intern at the Orange County Register. Over the years, he has gotten to know firefighters and their world, worked as a contractor for the U.S. Forest Service, and gone through formal wildland fire training. Sadly, in that time, there has been no shortage of material for his lens. His goal in documenting fires, as he tells the senior Hollywood correspondent Anthony Bresnikan, is to help people better prepare next time and help, quote, make firefighters' jobs easier in educating the public. The pictures featured here range from the Palisades fire initial spread to the wasteland and the other major blazes left behind as cleanup crews and homeowners re-entered the territory to sift through the wreckage. Stuart's photographs are both unflinching in their proximity to the flames and assured in their portrayal of resilience. If you would like to donate to Baby to Baby or to the MPTF, please visit their websites at babytobaby.org, which is babytobaby.org, and mptf.com. That was Editor's Letter by Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief. The next story is called Anatomy of a Fall by Chris Whipple. In his new book, Uncharted, the author dissects the 2024 presidential race. Here, he offers fresh reporting on the genesis of Harris's campaign and its sorrowful conclusion. The drama began the week before President Biden bowed out. At the time, Kamala Harris was navigating a political minefield. Any hint that she was plotting to replace the president could have been politically fatal. But while Harris was lying low, her political operation was working behind the scenes. Her chief of staff, Lorraine Vols, had been thinking about a contingency like this since November 19, 2021. That was when the president, under Section 3 of the 25th Amendment, had voluntarily transferred his powers and duties to Harris while he underwent a colonoscopy. It concentrated Vol's mind. She and her staff needed to be ready for anything. Still, taking Biden's place on the ticket was a lot more complicated and fraught than being the acting president for a day. To prepare, Harris's team launched a stealth operation. They recruited people with no direct connection to the VP. On Thursday, July 18, 3 days before Biden made his decision to step aside, a veteran Democratic operative heard from Stephanie Shvriak, the former head of Emily's List. "I got a call to help the Harris campaign come up with an if-he-drops-out plan," this operative told me. "Can you take a look at all the rules? What we would actually need to do in terms of signatures?" They 100% did not know at that point. They were like, We just feel like we should put a plan in place. Maybe something happens. We were all very careful that this was not Kamala. This was, if someone, Biden, wants to drop out, we desperately want a woman president, and us women have to be there. That was the framing. Other Harris allies were also wrangling prominent Democratic senators to make a promise. If Biden didn't retreat by Monday, July 22nd, they would call on him publicly to do so. Even at this late date, Nancy Pelosi, who had been putting her own pressure on Biden, was thought to oppose a coronation of Harris. She wanted a primary. Barack Obama reportedly wanted one too. And he was said to favor a governor, not Harris, as the nominee. But as Biden weighed his options at his Rehoboth Beach house that fateful weekend of July 20 to 21, he was practically alone. The only counsel he was taking was from close aides Steve Ricchetti and Mike Donilon. On Sunday, just a little after noon, Biden called Harris. The vice president, wearing sweatpants and a Howard University hoodie, was in the kitchen of the VP mansion at the U.S. Naval Observatory. The second gentleman, Doug Emhoff, was in California. Harris's niece, Mina, was visiting, and her two daughters, Harris's grandnieces, were sitting down to do a jigsaw puzzle. Her cell phone buzzed. "Hello, Mr. President," she said. "Listen," said Biden, "I've decided I'm not going to run." Harris sounded dumbfounded. She replied, "Are you sure? Are you sure you want to do that?" The president was sure. Biden hung up, but he called back to say the White House would announce his decision soon, and he would follow up with a tweet endorsing her. At 1:46 p.m., the White House released Biden's statement. At 2:13 p.m., he sent out the tweet. Now that Biden had actually ended his campaign, Harris would have to seize the nomination. She'd struggled with staff turnover during her first 2 years in office, but by 2024, she'd assembled a strong team, led by Voles, Sheila Nix, a senior advisor, Kirsten Allen, her comms director, and Brian Fallon, her senior comms advisor. They swiftly activated a formidable political machine. There was a political operation in place that was minding her P's and Q's well ahead of the ticket switch, said an advisor. We were just able to immediately utilize it for the sake of a whipping operation to secure the nomination. By that point, a dozen Harris advisors had joined the vice president around her dining room table. Laptops open, cell phones buzzing, they were wrangling support from around the country. Suddenly, Harris shouted, "Could someone please get hold of my husband?" She'd called the second gentleman three times and got his voicemail, but he was on the stationary bike at SoulCycle in San Francisco. Next, Harris stepped into the turret of the castle-like residence so she could speak without being overheard. First, she called Bill and Hillary Clinton. They offered their support and an immediate endorsement. She then called the Obamas. The 44th president was supportive, but said he wanted to wait a few days before endorsing her to avoid the appearance of a coronation. By now, Obama evidently preferred the appearance of a process to an actual open primary. Michelle was not only all in, she also offered to campaign with Harris, something she hadn't done for Biden. Harris's next calls were to potential rivals for the nomination, Governors Roy Cooper, Josh Shapiro, Gretchen Whitmer, J.B. Pritzker, and Gavin Newsom. Some asked Harris what the process would be. She replied crisply that it could be settled in the normal way. Whoever earned a majority of the pledged delegates would win the nomination, period. Cooper, Whitmer, Shapiro, and Newsom offered Harris their support that same day. Arizona Senator Mark Kelly followed suit. Outreach to potential running mates, she eventually chose Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, wouldn't begin for another week. Early in the afternoon, the enormity of what had happened struck Harris. It was a moment none of her advisors and friends would forget. The vice president called her pastor and put him on speakerphone. Reverend Amos C. Brown, 83, led Harris, Voles, Nix, and Allen in prayer, asking God for guidance and wisdom for the good of the country. "What does the Lord require of you but to do justice," he said, reciting from Micah 6:8, "and to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. The vice president was verklempt in tears. She welled up for sure, said an advisor. We all did. By 10 p.m. at the Naval Observatory, jigsaw pieces were still strewn across the kitchen table. But the puzzle of Harris's nomination had been solved. She'd called more than 100 people. Not a single potential rival had challenged her. By Monday, Harris had the backing of a majority of Democrats in Congress. Within 48 hours, she had the support of most delegates who would be at the convention. A senior advisor summed up Harris's two-day marathon as a political tour de force. A lot of people were like, we need a process. Well, there is a process, getting the delegates to commit. We just needed to do it, and we did it. 107 days later, as history will recount, Team Harris hit rock bottom. Yet it didn't seem so as Election Day dawned. Though Harris was behind in the battleground states, her spokespeople were oddly upbeat. Appearing on MSNBC back on October 27, campaign chair Jen O'Malley Dillon had declared, "We are very confident we're going to win this thing." On Friday, November 1, senior advisor David Plouffe posted on X that late-breaking undecided voters were going for Harris by more than 10 points. A campaign has a gravitational pull, and Chief of Staff Vols was feeling it. "You get sucked into the momentum," she said, "like you believe it. I've been on winning ones and losing ones, and this felt more like Bill Clinton's in 1992 than Michael Dukakis's in 1988. Vols wasn't talking poll numbers or analytics, but intangibles. The rallies were so big and so enthusiastic, people were lining the streets. But Harris's pollsters didn't share the kumbaya cohesion. One ex-Biden campaign official couldn't understand all the heady talk. They still had consistent polling results that showed her down by 2 in every state, she said, and Trump always overperforms. How the hell were they going to make that up? On election morning, Harris gathered with her family in the front part of the house, while in the back, Nix, campaign chief of staff Vols, and others monitored returns. O'Malley, Dillon, and company were running the campaign nerve center at the Marriott Marquis Hotel near Howard University, with an army of data crunchers keeping Harris and her inner circle informed as returns came in. The vice president was hunkered down with her family. "We saw her maybe one time that whole night," said one of her close insiders, when the VP came back to their section of the house. As the evening wore on, it was just like, what's going on? The SG, second gentleman, would come in. Doug would say, "What's happening?" The realization grew that it was going to be a difficult night. One key indicator, Vols had summoned a photographer and a videographer. They were supposed to head to the Howard University campus with Harris for her victory speech. Instead, they cooled their heels. The moment of truth came just after midnight. O'Malley Dillon huddled with her two best analytics experts. They were her barometer, her North Star, and when they told her they did not see a path, O'Malley Dillon knew there wasn't one. She called the vice president. "We're down in the blue wall states, and we're not going to be able to make it up," she said. "Oh, my God," said Harris. "What is going to happen to this country?" Suddenly, the race was over, as though someone had thrown a switch. "We sent people home," said a Harris aide. "And then, find Cedric." Cedric Richmond, a Harris confidant, was tapped to deliver the bad news to the faithful at Howard University. He took the stage at 12:45 a.m. There would be no declaration of victory that night. There would be no Harris presidency. Just after 1 a.m., O'Malley Dillon faced one of her most daunting tasks. She had to call her 12-year-old twin daughters. They'd gone knocking on doors for Harris in Arizona that weekend and were totally invested in the campaign. They'd sent their mother a note saying that they had to go to bed, but that they knew the numbers were going to turn for Harris. O'Malley Dillon called them on FaceTime to give them the news. And that was the moment when the steely Take No Prisoners campaign chair broke down. As Harris's devastated followers departed the campus courtyard, the ground was littered with discarded American flags and Harris Walls posters. The inspiring lightning speed campaign had imploded. so too, in ways too numerous to count, had its defiant theme, "We are not going back." There is a picture of Kamala Harris at Howard University, and she is bidding farewell to her supporters the day after the November defeat. She is seen from the waist up with her right hand held up in a wave, and she's in profile wearing a dark blue suit, and there's a microphone and a podium in front of her and the American flag. No photo credit is given. There is also a photo at night after the results came in on election night, and you can see barricades and all kinds of trash on the ground, a small American flag, and the words Harris Walls on a big banner in the background. There is no photo credit given. From the forthcoming book, Uncharted, How Trump Beat Biden, Harris, and the Odds in the Wildest Campaign in History, by Chris Whipple. Copyright 2025 by CC Whip Productions. Reprinted by permission of HarperCollins Publishers. That was Anatomy of a Fall, Inside the First Week and Final Hours of the Harris Campaign, by Chris Whipple. The next story is called Young Restless. With Beef and now The Last of Us on his resume, young Mazzino proves he's up to a challenge, by Rebecca Ford. After he filmed the first season of Beef, young Mazzino slipped away into Spain. He had no idea that the 2023 limited series with Steven Yeun and Ali Wong would make him a breakout star. But after Mazzino earned an Emmy nomination, he suddenly saw possibilities opening up. "I'm still perplexed by everything," says the actor. "I don't know where this world is headed, but it seems to get more and more surreal." Mazzino recently took another major trip, bouncing from Tokyo to Indonesia, because he just finished the second season of the wrenching zombie hit The Last of Us, which premieres April 13th. "I never judged my character, but he's a bit of a Boy Scout," says Mazzino. "He definitely tapped into the brighter, warmer side of myself, because I think I'm by default a little darker than him spiritually." Growing up the son of Korean immigrants in Silver Spring, Maryland, Mazzino felt like becoming an artist was an outlandish decision. He kept quiet about his love for theater. "I didn't want my friends in athletics to know I was doing the musical, so I never told anyone until they'd see me on the stage," he says. "I was dealing with an existential crisis before I even knew what that was." After dropping out of college, Mazzino decamped to New York, where he worked as a business analyst and studied at the Stella Adler Studio of Acting. When he registered with SAG-AFTRA, he discovered there were too many actors with his given name, Christopher Kim. So he went with his Korean name, Young, and a surname inspired by Yurik Mazzino, a character in the South Korean webtoon Tower of God. His ideal is to not just get to the top of this tower, but to leave the tower and be under the real stars, Mazzino says of his namesake. "That name was, in a way, to empower myself to strive for better and be greater than I felt." Even after finding success, Mazzino isn't sure how he fits into Hollywood as a Korean-American actor. "I do find myself in this weird kind of in-between," he says. "How selective can I be when I'm already in this weird space?" Lately, he's been spending time in Maryland with his family. Other than that, he lives nowhere in particular, though he's thinking about returning to New York. He just had a small role in the A24 thriller Opus. He'd love to work with Hirokazu Koreeda, Derek Cianfrance, and Terrence Malick someday. His mission, strange as it sounds, is to be uncomfortable. "I need to find myself in a room with people that are way beyond more talented than I am, because that's the only way I think I could really grow," Mazzino says. "I constantly want to be in a position where it's daunting." There is a picture of young Mazzino. It is black and white, and he is standing in front of a white background. He is wearing a black tank top and wide leg black pants. His arms are outstretched. They're kind of muscular, and in his right hand he's holding his suit jacket, and he has black, kind of spiky hair. Photo credit goes to Nick Riley Bentham. That was Young Restless. With Beef and now The Last of Us on his resume, young Mazzino proves he's up to a challenge by Rebecca Ford. The next story is called Other Words. Viet Thanh Nguyen explores what it means to be an outsider by Aaron Vanderhoof. In December 2023, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Viet Thanh Nguyen had something he felt needed to be said, and, luckily, a platform of unusual gravity on which to say it. Earlier that year, he was tapped to give the Norton Lectures, a nearly century-long Harvard series in which an artist addresses the public six times over the course of a year. This April, Nguyen will release To Save and to Destroy, Writing as Another, an edited compilation of the lectures preserving their piercing insight into the dilemmas faced by outsiders working in an insider literary culture. There is a task and a purpose for those who believe in literature. There is important work for us to do, he says. For those of us who are concerned about the injustices of our society, whether it's injustices being committed domestically or overseas in our name, there is a total relationship between beauty, art, truth, and justice. Nguyen is known for writing that distills the experiences of Asian Americans and addresses the Vietnam War, its complexities, and its aftermath, including The Sympathizer from 2015, which became an HBO limited series in 2024. The collection weaves in the work of those who inspire him, like Maxine Hong Kingston, Jeffrey Paul Chan, and Ken Chan, along with literary giants including Toni Morrison, James Baldwin, Herman Melville, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and Ralph Ellison. Nguyen had initially drafted the letters while in Paris the previous summer. October 7 happened literally between the second and third lecture, so I felt I had to address that and all of its consequences, he says. In a few weeks, he wrote a skillful argument urging Asian Americans to see a reflection of themselves in the Palestinian struggle. I felt like there was an organic relationship for me to Palestinian thought and anti-colonial thinking that was deeply tied into the Vietnam War and to me becoming an American. Though the lecture did occasion an audience interruption when it was delivered in December 2023, it fit comfortably with what he had initially planned, a series of emotional tales that makes palpable his intellectual understanding of an artist's role in the political discourse and the way politics works its way into art. We want the writer and the artist who will tell us that art will save us. But it's competing against this human impulse to destroy, he says. Art can illuminate the process in ways that are not there to make us feel better, but for us to realize how deeply embedded this impulse for destruction is. If we could realize it, then we can save ourselves. There is a picture of Viet Thanh Nguyen, and he is shown from the lower ribcage up. He is in a black jacket, black shirt. He has ink black hair, and he is turning his face towards the camera in a very dramatic way, with dramatic lighting kind of above him, and then there are brown curtains behind him. Photo credit goes to Jean Glover. That was Other Words, Viet Thanh Nguyen Explores What It Means to Be an Outsider, by Aaron Vanderhoof. The next story is called Gossip Girls. Conservative media has feasted on the fight between Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni. If you're full of hate for Hollywood, what's not to love? By David Canfield. Megyn Kelly isn't the most obvious candidate to land a scoop about a Hollywood feud. But in January, the right-leaning firebrand was joined on her SiriusXM program by Justin Baldoni's lead attorney, Brian Friedman. Kelly debuted a voice message from Baldoni to his dream team, editing the movie in which he described being, in Kelly's sympathetic paraphrasing, quote, put in the basement on the premiere of his own movie, to meet the alleged demands of his It Ends With Us co-star Blake Lively. Friedman then made a comprehensive case for his clients for just under 10 minutes. The YouTube clip alone passed 1 million views. Hollywood Trades picked up the story, and Friedman continued on his aggressive media tour. Baldoni's voice memo was part of the effort to soften his image. the director and star of It Ends With Us, entered 2025 having just been sued by Lively for creating a hostile work environment, with specific allegations, including sexual harassment. Baldoni called Lively's claims completely false, filed a $400 million countersuit against Lively and her husband, Ryan Reynolds, made constant media appearances, and released more selective correspondence. Meanwhile, Friedman has depicted Lively as a walking Hollywood nightmare. The ugly back and forth got play virtually everywhere after the New York Times reported the news of Lively's suit, but right-wing media truly milked the narrative. Kelly weighed in on seemingly any update that reflected well on Baldoni. She has also been represented by Friedman. The Daily Wire's Ben Shapiro asked if Lively would ever recover. Candace Owens discussed the battle on her online show nearly every day, casting Lively's misery as revenge for #MeToo. Right-wing talking heads love stories about liberal hypocrisy, and Hollywood is a great hunting ground. Coverage of the Lively-Baldoni affair, in fact, has resembled another grim case contested as much in the court of public opinion as the court of law, Depp versus Heard. Johnny Depp was awarded more than $10 million in damages from Amber Heard after a jury found her references in a Washington Post op-ed to, quote, sexual violence and, quote, domestic abuse to be false and defamatory of Depp. You can guess which side of the political aisle cheered this verdict with the most enthusiasm. Heard won one of her three countersuit claims and was awarded $2 million in damages. During the trial, you could tell the public was largely teamed up, as gleefully sexist memes mocking Heard proliferated on TikTok and YouTube. The campaign was facilitated by Depp's sophisticated crisis PR operation, the same firm, notably, that Baldoni hired, and further boosted by the Republican Party. The House Judiciary's GOP's official Twitter account applauded the news of Depp's court win. Donald Trump Jr. posted, quote, "Believe all women, except Amber Heard." The case presented the chance for a sweeping collective #MeToo backlash, abruptly reversing a five-year trend of powerful men facing consequences. Who cares if Depp once joked about assassinating Trump? At least he's a man. Unlike Heard, Lively has a famous and wealthy husband in Reynolds, and the right-wing's narrative now is that the Hollywood machine will stomp all over justice in the interest of feminism. They're clearly thinking that if the vilification of empathy can help elect a president, it can certainly boost ratings and clicks. Early this year, Kelly gave her audience an update. "Poor little meek, powerless Blake had to deal with Justin's aggressive advances. That's just so obviously a lie at this point," she said. She's made herself into Amber Heard, and the conservative media did everything they could to help. That was Gossip Girls. Conservative media has feasted on the fight between Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni. If you're full of hate for Hollywood, what's not to love? By David Canfield. That concludes today's reading from Vanity Fair magazine. This has been Melanie Goralnik for the Georgia Radio Reading Service. Thank you for listening to GARS.